How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. There are moments in life that define us, and then there are moments that undo us. Moments where a single decision, made in frustration, exhaustion, or overwhelm, sets off a chain reaction that changes everything. This week's conversation is with Chris Valley, author, keynote speaker, founder of The Voice Movement, Vulnerability Opens Inner Courage, and a man who knows intimately what it means to fall publicly. But behind the scenes, life was unravelling. A marriage breakdown, burnout, isolation. A transition into a new teaching environment without the support or tools he needed. And then, one moment in a classroom. A decision he now owns that led to a headline that would follow him to this day. Aggressive teacher who bullied students struck off. But this conversation isn't about a headline. It's about what happens after. What happens when everything you've built is stripped away? When your identity is questioned? When your mistakes are no longer private, but very public? Chris chose to do something many of us struggle to do. He told the truth. Through his memoir, Put the Phone Away. Through his work, and through the Voice Movement, he's turned one of the most difficult chapters of his life into a conversation about accountability, failure, and the courage it takes to be vulnerable in a world that often rewards perfection. Perhaps the real question isn't, how did this happen? But rather, what can we learn from it? Hello, Chris. I'm really keen to understand more about the boy than the man at this point. Where did you grow up and what type of environment would you describe your family home being?
Geez, I look back now and I think, how did mum do it? Seven kids. We grew up in South Dunedin, a 5-minute cruise to the beach, St Kilda, St Clair beaches, the Esplanade there where we just ran free. Brought up in a Catholic environment, so every Sunday we'd go to church. I've got triplets in my family, and they were named Tom, Richard, and Patricia, affectionately known as Tom, Dick, and Harriet. And memories of just sitting on the bench, trying to conform to all things religion and the little squabbles we used to have. Let alone did Mum have enough money to put some money in the offertory or in the plate? I look back on that, and I look. Now that I'm that dad and what it means to be a parent and to lead by example, to have values. Dunedin was a wonderful upbringing. Sport was our playground. We had those opportunities just to play sport and connect. And, we'd be kicking the footy till the lights turned out type thing. So a wonderful upbringing, really.
What sort of influence did your father have on you, and particularly when you were becoming a father?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mum and my father separated when I was 7 or 8. I didn't really know my father as a kid, and many years later struggled to really articulate any emotional connection or father figure influence, because I guess I had older brothers that were the ones I looked up to. And my father, he passed in 2000. I was in Southampton at the time doing the OE. And I got a call from Mum saying that he was on his deathbed. He got pretty crook. He had some sort of lung cancer or something to that effect. Not really an influence. A guy that I knew that was born in Invercargill was a truck driver. Used to, go to the pub, the old 6 o'clock swirl, and smoke a pipe. In many ways, a figment of my imagination. I didn't really know my father, and so it wasn't until you become a dad you start to ask those questions, and so. Yeah, I wish I did have a time machine. Wish I could go back and have conversations with Howard and what it meant to be a father of triplets and what it meant to be a father to me. And you just tell who he was, because I didn't really know him.
Life in New Zealand is unique in itself. How do you think the culture of New Zealand has made you who you are today?
It's something I've really tried to articulate, make sense of in recent times. You know, we talk about the multicultural lens that is New Zealand, especially Auckland with the Polynesian population. I'm living in Marlborough, top of the South Island, so we've got a huge multicultural presence here with a lot of people coming over for the vineyard season, with harvest, all that sort of stuff. A lot of Vanuatuans, you know, Pacifica people that are starting to come over here. But I do struggle with the word culture, especially as a bloke, that we had this upbringing where we had to be staunch. You know, we had to kick it in the guts. We had to harden the fuck up. And, you know, growing up in Dunedin, where there was a sense of, you know, drink spates, eat cheese rolls and play rugby, that was almost like an advertising campaign, and one that we all had to, you know, walk into or believe in terms of those values and those set expectations. So, and I guess we'll come to it, but in recent years, I've started to question that definition of culture and masculinity. And that masculinity isn't about that. It's actually being really emotional, intelligent, having the ability to stay connected and to actually say that I'm struggling, I'm knackered, I'm buggered. So I really looked up to my brothers. I had two brothers and a sister and the triplets. But, you know, that guy that was the youngest of seven, man, I danced, I played. I was the show-off, you know. We'd be in the TV lounge and dancing to, you know, MTV or 80s pop music and trying to be, you know, Boy George or Rick Astley, and just loved it. It was great.
Absolutely love that vision you've just created of you as a child, you know, because children are carefree and they do absorb so much of the world around them. How did your education experience influence how you travelled the career path?
I always said the gift of the gab, or that verbal diarrhea, or that self-confidence, or that willingness just to give it a crack. And if someone says, would you like to? There's not often that I would say no. And growing up Catholic, there was an expectation that if you went to, you know, a Catholic school, that you had to conform to the church and the gospel and all that jazz. And in recent years, I've questioned that because they, when you're trained to be a teacher, and that's what I got into, it was about, you know, critiquing the curriculum or asking our students to be critical thinkers. And you can't be critical thinkers unless you do some reading, you have understanding, you have knowledge. And a lot of that knowledge that I had came from my siblings, came from my mum, who modelled empathy, who modelled compassion, who modelled a work ethic that was exceptional. You know, we lost mum to cancer in 2004. And I was working as a tour guide at the time and taking clients around the South Island and based out of Queenstown, and was lucky enough to have the last 17 hours with mum before she passed. And I guess what she told us was about, you know, the old work ethic and that saying, treat others how you'd like to be treated. And it does come back to kindness. And sometimes when you judge or you criticize people, that doesn't do anybody any favors. And, you know, the opportunities that I got were just through writing, really. And it wasn't until I was at high school that I started to be involved with a journalism elective. Loved my first 15 and ended up, you know, being editor of the school newspaper, which landed me a cadetship at the local newspaper. So that was the pathway back in sort of the mid-90s, and it's something that I continued later on in life.
So why did you move from journalism into teaching yourself?
I had an ex-girlfriend who was in early childhood, and when we moved to Queenstown, she was working there, and I found an opportunity with AJ Hackett Bungie, and I was working on the front line there in customer service and just loved it, just the people aspect, just talking bollocks and thrashing music on the bridge and, you know, giving it that. And her mother said to me at the time, she goes, Chris, you'd be a great fit as a teacher. And I thought, bugger that, there's no way I'd do that. And I just had this perception that teaching was difficult, you know, academia. It was about having a high level of intelligence. And I never really thought that was me. And she dropped a seed, dropped a penny, and that penny was ultimately, yeah, I think there might be some stability there. There might be the chance to have 6 to 8 weeks holiday over the summer period and just be that guy that, you know, wanted to be seen, wanted to be heard, and wanted to be that teacher that was there for the kids. So I got a Bachelor of Education, a 3-year degree, endorsed in primary education, and had a part-time job at what was then known as Civic Video, which was not a bad wee gig, actually, especially a few romantic comedies and an opportunity really just to, you know, watch free DVDs. But it was hard yards, you know, 2 minute noodles. I was early 30s when I went back to school or back to uni. The only one in the family out of seven that got a university qualification. So that's something I'm proud of. Not to say that the other brothers and sisters didn't have success, but a proud moment when in 2010 I got the qualification. You know, Mum was no longer then, and had a wee moment, went up to the cemetery, and I remember saying to Mum, you know, this one's for you.
What did you find most challenging about entering the education system, even with primary school students? Because I've spoken with a lot of educators over the years, and that period you're talking about is when children and families began to change.
I knew when I looked at the numeracy curriculum that first year as an adult student that I was so far removed from the classroom that I didn't understand strategies or the numeracy framework, but I knew literacy. I knew how to write a sentence. I knew how to, you know, connect with people. So I felt like I was on the back foot when I first started. For me, the real learning came on placements when you were exposed to the diversity of learners and the colleagues that you worked with. You would sit down and have conversations that were better than a lecture theatre because they were lived experiences. And the people that mentored me and others were invaluable, and a lot of them are no longer teaching for whatever reason. But I look back on that time and I go, when you find proximity, when you find a sense of someone who's been there, done that, that's the greatest resource.
You crossed over from primary school into musical theatre teaching and went into a secondary school. How different was that from your previous experience?
It was huge. There's something about primary teaching where it's about the fundamentals of literacy and numeracy, about the fun aspect of learning. When you go into secondary, it's about behaviours and systems and understanding teenagers that are complex. And I thought I fell short when I look back on the transition in 2019. I left primary ultimately to become a drama teacher. And I saw an opportunity to be an English teacher at a local college, and I thought, here's my chance. But it was difficult. I didn't have the toolbox, didn't have the strategies, didn't have the experience. And, you know, this is before COVID, so it was complex. I was confused and I was very much lost.
That's quite a vulnerable statement in itself to make in relation to, you know, just how challenging things can be for teachers. But ultimately, you know, things became a lot more than that in relation to having to manage and navigate the relationship between teacher and students. What happened?
Just juggling too much. When I look back at the musical theatre, I got my first introduction to that in 2015. First show was Full Monty, you know, local primary school teacher getting his kid off. And, you know, parents coming to the show. It was a bit of a baptism of fire in terms of community 101. And a small town scenario, you know, but I thrived in that musical theatre environment because I could escape, I could put on a mask. What happened? I didn't slow down. I was juggling too much. Throughout this period, you know, we'd done Mamma Mia, we did Annie, you know, we'd done Phantom of the Opera. So I was exposed to all these shows and all these learnings, and ultimately I was never present with my ex-wife. And it was during that time that we were looking at to build a home. And so she suggested that we moved in with her parents. Now, that for me was the start of my mental health journey in terms of feeling lost and had no voice. You know, living with the in-laws was very complex because, you know, I had everything done for me. I'd come home from school and the meal was there, dishes were done. You know, my undies were folded, you know, all that stuff was done for me. So what happened? I was buggered. I was knackered. But I didn't have the ability to just, you know, step back because I felt like an obligation not only to being a teacher but also to the community with musical theatre and trying to bring home the bacon, and that was providing an income. But ultimately, you know, me and the ex-wife, we just drifted. And so you talk about vulnerability, which translates to open wound. What happened ultimately was I was bullshitting myself. I wasn't honest. And I was unfaithful in my marriage to my ex-wife. And that's something I take to my grave. And so it's about learning and implementing and actioning what was. The advocacy right now has never been more about being present, what it means to be a bloke, what it means to have not only conversations, but start to really align or be proactive about my experiences and help those that perhaps are struggling. Because it's not about me anymore. It's not about my story. I've been fortunate in recent years. And so the ability to hopefully bring that together, that's the advocacy moving forward.
How did that period impact your work life, given you weren't present in your own personal life?
I was really angry, more perhaps confused is the word, confused by my purpose, what my role was. You know, I'd sit there in staff meetings and I'd go, I don't understand the curriculum language, and I'd reach out to the former colleague and we just weren't on the same page. You know, I had to find students that were on cell phones, and if there's any behaviours, those students went to their teacher. You know, what does that say to the student? It's almost like an out. And so I had a realm of emotions. Ultimately, I was confused. And so when I became the musical theatre guy, and you do a show and people started doing that, that made me feel really good. It made me feel heard, acknowledged, valued. And I think we all want to be seen and we all want to be heard. And as a parent, as a husband and as a teacher, when I gave my voice or my critical lens or my opinion, I never felt like I was listened to. And so when you deal with all these emotions, it starts to process and it starts to bottle up. So it was shit. It was really shit. But it was a time where I look back now and I go, there's a reason why I went through that, and there has to be a reason. And I guess what's happened, you know, the past 12 months has been, you know, a reflection on that.
What did you take away from that experience of snatching a phone off a child and the repercussions that occurred following it? How was that the catalyst for you writing about your experience?
Well, the book came off the back of the headline. So in March 25, the headline read, "Aggressive teacher who bullied student struck off." After the incident with the cell phone in 2019, that became an investigation, went to the Teachers Council here in New Zealand. February, March of 2020, I got an email saying that I was under investigation. By then, my marriage was broken. It was finished and we were still living together. I was looking at moving out, finding a new home. I transitioned to another school as head of drama during that time, COVID, the pandemic. We're all learning from home for 6 weeks. And then in 21, through my union spokesperson, I had to sign what's called a undertaking not to teach, discretionary leave. And so I was on leave for 30 months. So in January 24, I got a email from the Teachers Council representative saying that I was unfit now to be a teacher based on what had happened and the pattern of events around being angry or being unprofessional. And so I lost my identity. And when the headline came out last year in March 25, I looked at the word aggressive and I thought to myself, that wasn't me. And the more I thought about it, the more I was actually quite angry. I was angry with the fact I never got support. I felt isolated, and I felt like I was the guinea pig. You know, they hired a guy to be a head of drama who had done a few musical theatre shows but had no pedagogy, had no skill set. How do you teach a practical subject on Zoom? So it was a difficult time, and musical theatre became a great escape. And so in 2022, I was involved with Les Miserables and ended up being a community journalist for a local newspaper, and promoting that was just wonderful. And when you're on stage, you know, on the barricade, being on one of the great Western, so the great West End musicals, it was a great escape. So the book came off the back of the headline, and the headline for me was about providing context. The journalist that wrote the story never called me. There was no equity in the story. Investigators went back to the school 2 years after the incident and interviewed students. So I approached 5 New Zealand publishers. Not one got back to me because there's a perception, teacher, investigation, and people make up their own mind. And for a guy that told other people's stories for 4 years as the community journalist, I thought it was about time I told my story. So in May last year, I started writing, and what turned out to be, you know, 30,000 words and 12, 13 chapters became a book called Put the Phone Away. You know, I had some pretty difficult students, and I didn't have the tools, didn't have the ability to recognize how shagged I was. So I look back now, and I'm really proud of that. And so I live in a small community here in Marlborough. There's a lot in the book. It's pretty raw. And it wasn't until I met a guy two or three years ago, a guy called Doug Avery, a local farmer, and he penned a book called The Resilient Farmer, and he basically had his own mental health journey too. And he's a guy that's in his 60s, early 70s, and he broke down and cried in front of me after I interviewed him. And I thought to myself, God, there's something really palpable about a grown man crying, something really real. And so that's been the advocacy, you know, like, we've got to redefine what masculinity looks like, because it's bullshit. You know, we're wearing all these masks, you know, and if we're going to be any favor to our partners, we don't need to put our shit on them. You know, we've got to be accountable. And so for me, there's been some wonderful learnings.
There's now a global movement to revisit the conversation around children having access to devices, especially connected with social media accounts under 16. What impact do you think this story has had on the school systems in relation to phone use?
Well, I think it's a work in progress. You know, I spoke to a principal recently, a good colleague of mine, and, you know, some of the teachers aren't buying into it. You know, this implementation around, you know, putting your phones away. Some teachers are choosing not to address it because it's not part of their job description. It's about consistency. It's a values-based conversation. It's about looking at it from a parent lens, a school lens, a community lens. You know, we've got a responsibility, a collective responsibility to understand the why. Why are they going on their phones? You know, and when you see that lack of critical thinking or creativity or collaboration, and the fundamentals of literacy and numeracy that they're leaving school with should be there, that aren't there. You only need to look at when the smartphone came into effect in 2011, 2012, and you see these patterns, these results. So it's a beast. I'm now a dad of a 13-year-old daughter who is trying to find her niche, trying to find her network through online. You know, this thing about a notification or a bing or a like. It's a scary world we live in. And those days of going to the pub and having a pint and having a whinge or connecting with someone, something in that. But also there'll be something in playing Monopoly. You know, why don't we get our board games anymore? Why don't we play Trivial Pursuit? Why do we need to escape? Yeah, and you see it at the supermarket, you know, at the checkout. People that really aren't present, they feel uncomfortable because they need to do something with their hands. The ability just to go, I'm here, this is my environment. G'day, how are you? Make eye contact. And I'll give you a closing thought. Recently, a lady at the supermarket said to me, how are you? And I said, oh, I've had a pretty shit day, really. And her face was just, she was confused because she didn't expect me to reply. And for me, that's connection. You know, we've got to get in front of people's faces. You know, smile at people. You know, positive reinforcement. You are worthy. You are of value. And so when you put a screen in front of people, yeah, it takes away the human connection.
What's the next step?
I think it's about, you know, ultimately finding a group of blokes, wives, people that have a similar story around wearing too many masks. And really, not only talking about redefining masculinity or that vulnerability is a strength in terms of, you know, connection 101, but starting to implement that through action, that we're seeing outcomes through well-being. So if we can model, if we can listen, if we can show the compassion and be kind. You know, and just to finish, I remember talking, there was a thing about Jacinda Ardern that when she took over the leadership of New Zealand, that she got critiqued for being kind and not looking at the fiscal envelope. Sure, you know, the economy is what it is now, and recession, and everyone's doing it tough, you know, economically, but there's something about kindness that goes a long way, and the ability just to be present. And so for me, being present now isn't doing that, isn't giving feedback, it's actually about listening. I think that helps a person unbelievably when you don't judge and are literally just there for that person. That's when they feel seen and that's when they feel heard.
Chris Valley, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing your story and understanding, you know, where you're going and why you want to have that impact on the next generation. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to more conversations and updates.
Thank you. And, you know, the wonderful thing about this conversation is that, you know, we connected through LinkedIn and there's no irony lost. It's called Put the Phone Away, but of course we met online. So, you know, if I ever get to that part of Australia, you can rest assured I'll be shouting a schooner.
Chris, thank you. Thank you for your honesty, your accountability, and your willingness to sit in the discomfort of your own story so that others might find understanding in theirs. What stood out in this conversation isn't the mistake, but what you chose to do next. Not deflect or deny. You wrote, reflected, and rebuilt. And in doing so, you've created something extremely human. A reminder that failure is not the end of our story, but often it's the beginning of our growth. To recognise where we've fallen short and have the courage to do better. Because if we want to guide our children, our students, our communities, we must first be willing to understand ourselves. If you're listening to this, if this conversation resonated with you, I encourage you to explore Chris's book, Put the Phone Away, and his work around vulnerability and education. And as always, perhaps we can reflect on this. What are we teaching our children? Not just in what we say, but in how we respond when we get it wrong. You can find all of my contact details in the show notes, as well as all the links to Chris's book and social platforms. Until we're together again, let's be the change we want to see in the world.